To a woman, Senora, man's duties and responsibilities begin and end with the task of getting bread for her children. To her, man is only a means to the end of getting children and rearing them.
Is that your idea of a woman's mind? I call it cynical and disgusting animalism.
Oh, pardon me, Anna. I said nothing about a woman's whole mind. I spoke of her view of man as a separate sex. It is no more cynical than her view of herself as, above all things, a mother. Sexually, woman is nature's contrivance for perpetuating its highest achievement. Sexually, man is woman's contrivance for fulfilling nature's behest in the most economical way. Now, she knows, by instinct, that far back in the evolutional process, she invented him, differentiated him, created him in order to produce something better than the single-sexed process can produce. Now, while he fulfills the purpose for which he made him, he's welcome to his dreams, his follies, his ideals, provided, of course, that the keystone of them all is the worship of woman, of motherhood, of the family, of the heart. But how rash and dangerous it was to invent a separate creature whose sole function was her own impregnation. For mark what has happened. First, man has multiplied on her hands until there are as many men as women. She has been unable to employ for her purposes more than a fraction of the immense energy she has left at his disposal by saving him the exhausting labor of gestation. That superfluous energy has gone to his brain and to his muscle. Yes, he has become too strong to be controlled by her bodily and too imaginative and mentally vigorous to be content with mere self-reproduction. He has invented civilization without consulting her, taking her domestic labor for granted as the foundation of it.
That is true, at all events.
Yes, and this civilization, what is it after all?
After all, an excellent peg to hang your cynical commonplaces on. But before all, it is an attempt on man's part to be something more than the mere instrument of woman's purpose. So far, the result of life's continual effort not only to maintain itself, but to achieve higher and higher organization and complete self-consciousness is only at best a doubtful campaign between its forces and those of death and degeneration. The battles in this campaign are mere blunders, mostly won like actual military battles in spite of the commanders.
That is a dig at me. No matter, go on, go on.
It is a dig at a much higher power than you, Commander. Still, you must have noticed in your profession that even a stupid general can win battles when the enemy's general is a little stupider.
Most true, most true. And some donkeys have amazing luck.
Well, the life force is stupid, but it is not so stupid as the forces of death and degeneration. Besides, these are in its pay all the time. And so life wins after a fashion. What mere copiousness of a quantity can supply and mere greed preserve we possess. The survival of whatever form of civilization can produce the best rifle and the best fed rifleman is assured.
Exactly. The survival not of the most effective means of life, but of the most effective means of death. You always come back to my point, in spite of your wrigglings and evasions and sophistries, not to mention the intolerable length of your speeches.
Oh, come, come now. Who began making long speeches? However, if I overtax your intellect, you can leave us and seek the society of love and beauty and the rest of your favorite boredoms.
This is not fair, Don Juan, and not civil. I am arguing fairly with you, and I think successfully refuting you. Let us go on for another hour, if you like.
Good. Let us.
Not that I see any prospect of your coming to any point in particular, Juan. Still, since in this place, instead of merely killing time, we have to kill eternity, go ahead, by all means.
My point, you marble-headed old masterpiece, my point is only a step ahead of you. Are we agreed that life is a force that has made innumerable experiments in organizing itself, that the mammoth and the man, the mouse and the megatherium, the flies and the fleas and the fathers of the church are all more or less successful attempts to to build up that raw force into higher and higher individuals. The idea of individual being omnipotent, omniscient, infallible, and withal completely and illudedly self-conscious, in short, a god.
I agree for the sake of argument.
I agree for the sake of avoiding argument.
I most emphatically disagree as regards the fathers of the church, and I must beg you not to drag them into the argument.
I did so purely for the sake of alliteration, and I shall make no further allusion to them. And now, since we are, with that exception, agreed so far, will you not agree with me further that life has not measured the success of its attempt at godhead by the beauty or bodily perfection of the result, since in both these respects, the birds, as our friend Aristophanes long ago pointed out, are so extraordinarily superior with their power of flight, their lovely plumage, and may I add, the touching poetry of their loves and nestings, that it is inconceivable that life, having once produced them, should, if love and beauty were our object, start off on another line and labor at the clumsy elephant or the hideous ape whose grandchildren we are.
Aristophanes was a heathen, and you, Juan, I'm afraid, are very little better.
You conclude, then, that life was driving at clumsiness and ugliness.
No, perverse devil that you are. 1,000 times no. Life was driving at brains, at its darling object, an organ by which it can attain not only self-consciousness, but self-understanding.
Oh, this is metaphysics, Juan. Why the devil... Oh, I beg your pardon, Mr. Lewis.
Oh, pray don't mention it, Commander. I have always regarded the use of my name to secure additional emphasis as a high compliment to me. It is entirely at your service.
Ah, thank you. That's very good of you.
Not at all.
Even in heaven, I never quite got out of my old military habits of speech. No, what I was going to ask Juan was why life should bother itself about getting a brain. Why should it want to understand itself? Why not be content to enjoy itself?
Without a brain, Commander, you would enjoy yourself without knowing it, and so lose all the fun.
Huh? true, quite true. Yes. Still, I'm quite content with brain enough to know that I'm enjoying myself. I don't particularly want to understand why. In fact, I'd rather not. My experience is that one's pleasures don't bear thinking about.
That is why intellect is so unpopular. But to life, the force behind the man, intellect is a necessity because without it, he blunders into death. Just as life, after ages of struggle, evolved that wonderful bodily organ, the eye, so that the living organism could see where it was going and what was coming to help or threaten it and thus avoid 1,000 dangers that formerly slew it, so it is evolving today a mind's eye that shall see not the physical world, but the purpose of life, and thereby enable the individual to work for that purpose instead of thwarting and baffling it by setting up short-sighted personal aims as at present. Even as it is, only one sort of man has ever been happy, has ever been universally respected among all the conflicts of interest and illusion.
You mean the military man?
I'm sorry, Commander. I do not mean the military man. When the military man approaches, the world locks up its spoons and packs off its womankind. No, I sing not arms and the hero, but the philosophic man. He who seeks in contemplation to discover the inner will of the world. In invention to discover the means of fulfilling that will, and in action to do that will by the so discovered means. Of all other sorts of men, I declare myself tired. They are tedious failures. When I was on earth, professors of all sorts prowled around me, you know, feeling for some unhealthy spot in me on which they could fasten. The doctors of medicine bade me consider what I must do to save my body. They offered me quack cures for imaginary diseases. I replied that I was not a hypochondriac, so they called me ignoramus and went their way. The doctors of divinity bade me consider what I must do to save my soul. But I was not a spiritual hypochondriac any more than a bodily one and would not trouble myself about that either. So they called me atheist and went their way. After them came the politician, who told me that the only purpose in nature was to get him into parliament. I told him that I did not care whether he got into parliament or not, So he called me Mangrump and went his way. Then came the romantic man, the artist, with his love songs and his paintings and his poems. And with him I had great delight for many years and some profit, for I cultivated my senses for his sake, and his songs taught me to hear better, his paintings to see better, and his poems to feel more deeply. But he led me at last into the worship of woman.
Juan!
Yes, I came to believe that in her voice was all the music of the song, in her face all the beauty of the painting, and in her soul all the emotion of the poem.
And you were disappointed, I suppose. Well, was it her fault that you attributed all these perfections to her?
Yes, partly. For, with a wonderful, instinctive cunning, she kept silent and allowed me to glorify her, to mistake my own visions, thoughts, and feelings for hers. Now, my friend, the romantic man, was often too poor and too timid to approach those women who were beautiful and refined enough to seem to realize his ideal. And so he went to his grave, believing in his dream. But I was more favored by nature and circumstance. I was of noble birth and rich. So when my person did not please, my conversation flattered. Though I must say, I generally found myself fortunate in both.
Coxcomb.
Yes, but even my coxcombry pleased. Well, I found that when I had tested a woman's imagination, she would allow me to persuade myself that she loved me. But when my suit was granted, she would never say, I am happy, my love is satisfied. No, she would always say, first, at last, the barriers are down. And second, when will you come again?
That is exactly what men say.
I protest, I never said it. But all women say it. Well, these two speeches always alarmed me. For the first meant that the lady's impulse had been solely to throw down my fortifications and gain my citadel. And the second openly announced that henceforth she regarded me as her property and considered my time as already wholly at her disposal.
That is where your want of heart came in.
You shouldn't repeat what a woman says, Juan.
It should be sacred to you.
Still, they certainly do say it. I never minded the barriers. There's always a slight shock about that coming back again business. Unless, of course, one was very hard hit indeed.
Then the lady, who had been happy and idle enough before, became anxious, preoccupied with me, always intriguing, conspiring, waiting, watching, pursuing, bent wholly on making sure of her prey. I being the prey, you understand. Now, this was not at all what I had bargained for. Mind you, it may have been very proper and very natural, but it was not beauty, music, poetry, and joy incarnated into a beautiful woman. So I ran away from it. Yes, I ran away from it very often. In fact, I became famous for running away from it.
Infamous, you mean?
I did not run away from you, Anna. Do you blame me for running away from the others?
Oh, nonsense, man. You're talking to a woman of 77 now. If you had had the chance, you would have run away from me, too, if I'd let you. You would not have found it so easy with me as with some of the others. If men will not be faithful to their home and their duties, they must be made to be. I dare say you all want to marry lovely incarnations of music and painting and poetry. Well, you can't have them because they don't exist. If flesh and blood is not good enough for you, you must go without, that's all. Women have to put up with flesh and blood husbands, and little enough of that, too, sometimes. And you will have to put up with flesh and blood wives. Oh, I see you don't like that. Any of you. But it's true for all that. So, if you don't like it, you can lump it.
My dear lady, you have put my whole case against romance into a few sentences. That is just why I turned my back on the romantic man with the artist's nature, as he called his infatuation. I thanked him for teaching me to use my eyes and ears, but I told him that his beauty-worshipping and happiness-hunting and woman-idealizing was not worth a damp as a philosophy of life. So he called me Philistine and went his way.
It seems that woman taught you something, too, with all her defects.
Oh, she did more. She interpreted all the other teaching for me. Ah, my friends, when the barriers were down for the first time, what an astounding illumination. I had been prepared for infatuation, for intoxication, for all the illusions of love's young dream. And lo, never was my perception clearer, nor my criticism more ruthless. The most jealous rival of my mistress never saw every blemish in her more keenly than I. I was not duped. I took her without chloroform.
Ah, but you did take her.
That was a revelation. Up to that moment, I had never lost the sense of being my own master. Never. Consciously taken one single step until my reason had examined and approved it. I'd come to believe I was a purely rational creature, a thinker. I said, with a foolish philosopher, I think, therefore I am. It was woman who taught me to say, I am, therefore I think, and also I would think more, therefore I must be more.
This is extremely abstract and metaphysical, one. If you would stick to the concrete and put your discoveries in the form of some entertaining anecdotes about your adventures with women, your conversation would be easier to follow.
Ah, what need I add? Do you not understand when I stood face to face with woman? Every fiber in my clear, critical brain warned me to spare her and save myself. My morals said no, my conscience said no, my chivalry and pity for her said no, my prudent regard for myself said no. My ear practiced on 1,000 songs and symphonies. My eye exercised on 1,000 paintings, tore her voice, her features, her color to shreds. I caught all those telltale resemblances to her father and mother by which I knew what she would be like in 30 years' time. I noted the gleam of gold from a dead tooth in the laughing mouth, the visions of my romantic reveries, in which I had trod the plains of heaven with a deathless, ageless creature of coral and ivory. Deserted me in that supreme hour. I remember them and desperately strove to recover their illusion, but they now seemed the emptiest of inventions. My judgment was not to be corrupted. My brain still said no on every issue. But while I was in the act of framing my excuse to the lady, life seized me and threw me into her arms, as a sailor throws a scrap of fish into the mouth of a seabird.
Well, you might as well have gone without thinking such a lot about it, Juan. You're like all clever men. You have more brains than is good for you.
And were you not happier for the experience, Senor Don Juan?
Happier? No. Wiser? Yes. That moment introduced me for the first time to myself and through myself to the world. I saw then how useless it is to attempt to impose conditions on the irresistible force of life, to preach prudence, careful selection, virtue, honor, chastity.
Don Juan, a word against chastity is an insult to me.
Oh, I said nothing against your chastity, Senora. Since it took the form of a husband and 12 children, what more could you have done had you been the most abandoned of women?
I could have had 12 husbands and no children. That's what I could have done, Juan. And let me tell you that that would have made all the difference to the earth, which I replenish.
Oh, bravo, Anna. Juan, you are flawed, quelled, annihilated.
No, for though that difference is the true, essential difference, Doña Anna has, I must say, gone straight to the real point. Yet it is not a difference of love or chastity or even constancy. For 12 children by 12 different husbands might have replenished the earth, perhaps more effectively. Now, suppose my friend Ottavio had died when you were 30. You would never have remained a widow. You were too beautiful. Now, suppose a successor of Ottavio had died when you were 40. You would still have been irresistible. And a woman who marries twice marries three times if she becomes free to do so. Well, 12 lawful children borne by one highly respectable lady to three different fathers is not impossible, nor condemned by public opinion. That such a lady may be more law-abiding than the poor girl whom we used to spurn into the gutter for bearing one unlawful infant is no doubt true, but dare you say she is less self-indulgent?
She is more virtuous. That is enough for me.
Well, in that case, what is virtue but the trade unionism of the married? Oh, let us face the facts, dear Anna. The life force respects marriage only because marriage is a contrivance of its own to secure the greatest number of children and the closest care of them. For honor, virtue, chastity, and the rest of your moral figments, it cares not a rat. Marriage is the most licentious of human institutions.
Oh, well, really?
I say the most licentious of human institutions. That is the secret of its popularity. And a woman seeking a husband is the most unscrupulous of all the beasts of prey. The confusion of marriage with morality has done more to destroy the conscience of the human race than any other single error. Come, Anna, do not look shocked. You know better than any of us that marriage is a man's trap, baited with simulated accomplishments and elusive idealizations. When your sainted mother, by dint of scoldings and punishments, forced you to learn how to play half a dozen pieces on the spinet, which she hated as much as you did, had she any other purpose than to delude your suitors into the belief that your husband would have in his home an angel who would fill it with melody, or at least play him to sleep after dinner? Well, you married, my friend Ottavio. Did you ever open the spinet from the hour when the church united him to you?
Oh, you are a fool, Juan. A young married woman has something else to do than sit at the spinet without any support for her back, so she gets out of the habit of playing.
Not if she loves music. No, believe me. She only throws away the bait when the bird is in the net.
And men, I suppose, never throw off the mask when their bird is in the net. The husband never becomes negligent, selfish, brutal. Oh, never.
What do these recriminations prove, Anna? Only that the hero is as gross an imposter as the heroine.
Oh, it's all nonsense. Most marriages are perfectly comfortable.
Perfectly is a strong expression, Anna. What you mean is that sensible people make the best of one another. Send me to the galleys and chain me to the prisoner whose number happens to be next before mine, and I must accept the inevitable and make the best of the companionship. Many such companionships, they tell me, are touchingly affectionate, and most are at least tolerably friendly, but that does not make a chain a desirable ornament, nor the galleys an abode of bliss.
Oh, pooh!
Those who talk most about the blessings of marriage and the constancy of its vows are the very people who declare that if the chain were broken and the prisoners left free to choose, the whole social fabric would fly asunder. Well, you cannot have the argument both ways. If the prisoner is happy, why lock him in? If he is not, why pretend that he is?
At all events, let me take an old woman's privilege again and tell you flatly that marriage peoples the world and debauchery does not.
How if a time come when this shall cease to be true? Do you not know that where there is a will, there is a way? That what man really wishes to do, he will finally find a means of doing. Well, you have done your best, you virtuous ladies and others of your way of thinking, to bend man's mind wholly towards honorable love as the highest good, and to understand by honorable love romance, beauty, and happiness in the possession of beautiful, refined, delicate, affectionate women. You have taught women to value their own youth, health, shapeliness, and refinement above all things. Well, what place have squalling babies, household cares, in this exquisite paradise of the senses and emotions? Is it not the inevitable end of it all that the human will shall say to the human brain, invent me a means by which I can have beauty, passion, without their wretched penalties, their trials, their worries, their illnesses and agonies and risks of death, their retinue of servants and doctors, and schoolmasters?
All this, Senor Don Juan, is realized here in my realm.
Yes. At the cost of death, man will not take it at that price. He demands the romantic delights of your hell while he's still on earth. Well, the means will be found. The brain will not fail when the will is in earnest. The day is coming when the viciously, reckless poor and the stupidly pious rich will delay the extinction of the race only by degrading it, while the lovers of money and solid comfort, the worshippers of success, of art, and of love, will all oppose to the force of life the device of sterility.